have taken place at SFU. So back in January, I chatted with Daniel Sheriff, Associate Director of the SFU Black Student Center, about their upcoming opening of the Black Student Center, which is a newly renovated and dedicated space created to support SFU's diverse Black community. And a bit of a background, the Black Student Center acts as a source of support, community, and connection for Black identifying students, faculty, and staff. It's designed with Black students' experiences and needs at the forefront, and the center provides a welcoming environment where members of SFU's Black community can gather, connect, and access support and resources. And as part of celebrating Black History Month, the Black Student Center Student Day Open House took place on Friday, February 6th, so just a couple weeks ago, and I had the chance to attend, and I will say it was such a fulfilling experience. First off, the center is absolutely beautiful. When I arrived, it was bustling with action. A lot of people were there, so such a great turnout. A DJ was spinning some sweet tunes. There was a bunch of students hanging out and singing songs and just laughing. Like, the energy was just incredible, such a vibe. People were even like chair dancing. That's one of the things I love to do, especially when I'm playing music on air. That's what I'm doing. And lots of folks were eating delicious food. The design of the space is so pleasing to the eye. Like, I absolutely love it because not only is it like got this fresh energy, fresh vibe, it's also so spacious. There is like hangout areas. There's like a kitchen. There's tables for studying. Beautiful artwork is like adorning the walls. Like, honestly, such a vibe. So if you are at SFU Burnaby campus, please, you know, swing by just to take a look because it's gorgeous. And when I arrived, okay, my timing was incredible because I arrived just in time to fix myself a delicious plate of food. So let me tell you what I had. I had a Jamaican patty because I absolutely love Jamaican patties. I actually make a pretty good Jamaican patty myself. Then I had a chicken samosa, and samosas are also one of my favorites. The chicken samosa was so delicious, and they also had like vegetable option, and then they had a beef option as well. And then the last thing that I added to my plate was a chapati, which is also known as roti, and that's a popular unleavened flatbread that I personally love to eat with like curry goat, curry chicken, or curry beef. So I got my plate sorted, and then I went through a door that was adjacent to the kitchen in the space, which led to like another space with several rooms, and I easily found the room where a panel discussion that I wanted to listen in on, and that was called the BSC Student Day Panel. The discussion was presented by the SFU Future Black Scientists Initiative, and the topic was called Building Black Futures, Career Pathways, Entrepreneurship, and Innovation. So let's have a listen to an audio clip that I took. It was such a rich conversation and so informative to hear the experiences of what it's like to grow up being Black in BC, or what it's like to work as a Black person in BC. And there was like a representation from various professions, so it was super, super interesting. Sorry. And I myself was born in Toronto and grew up in Toronto. But as I listened, I realized that although my experience growing up in Toronto was a bit different, there were so many similarities, especially when it comes to microaggressions and racism. So let's have a listen.
These questions are just open-ended, so you can go off of it. We're really excited to hear like your own personal stories and your diverse takes. So super simple, what inspired you in this the era that you are in now? What inspired you to go into this field?
Yeah, so I think I'll go first. What really inspired me, I think, was just my passion for technology. Originally, I had a lot of pressure from my parents. I think everyone will know, if you have African parents, you have to be a doctor, an engineer, or something related to that. So they kept asking me, what do you want to do? I'm like, oh yeah, I want to be like a civil engineer. They'll be like, oh wow, that's impressive. I'm like, yeah, yeah. And then I switched last minute to business. Then I switched again to computer science back because I thought that was like a good balance between, you know, my passion for technology, but also I hated physics with a passion. So I would say the first kind of chance I had to be exposed to anything kind of like computer science related was maybe like grade 11. I had this friend, he was like, you know, there's this free course online, you should go ahead and take it. And I did. It was some sort of like Python coding course, and I never looked back after that. I just thought, like, you know, computer science was what I wanted to do, software engineering was what I wanted to do, and I, you know, I just decided that's what I wanted to study in university and pursue. So yeah.
Thank you, brother. You know, when I was looking at these questions and I looked at in terms of what inspired you, all I can think of was when I was young, I wouldn't have known anything in terms of what would have been inspiring. Role models for me were like Michael Jordan, but I couldn't meet him or see him. And so what inspired me was what I can do. There was no black counselors in our community or in our neighborhood where I'm from. Where I'm from, unfortunately, there's labels that get put on it. Labels like poor and gang and violence and those kind of language. And what inspired me was I can actually be a black counselor. So 20 years ago, I started out my career as a counselor. And what inspired me was black families, black students, black children can now don't have to retell their story. And they can sit with a counselor. And these are just labels and names, but they can sit with somebody who can understand that. And why I'm so appreciative of this and to what you were sharing. African families, Caribbean families, we don't oftentimes get that space to have those dialogues or those conversations. I can hear my mom currently right now in the back of my mind saying, you know, why a bit, you know, I'm tired, you're hungry. And it's just like, man, it was all so very cutthroat. But I don't want to label my mom only as such, because she was also an educator. And I'll never forget when she was introducing Roots of Empathy to her classroom. And I remember looking at her saying, I don't know any empathy of a root in you, mom. So I stay inspired by my mom. Anybody that knows me, I speak highly of my mom. I'm truly blessed and privileged and grateful for my mom. So Roots of Empathy.
Thank you. I think I knew I wanted to be a doctor when I was six. I don't know if anyone knows that cartoon Doc McStuffins.
Yeah.
I thought I was her, so I don't know what that did for my childhood. But I think it became one of those things I had to kind of reevaluate as I grew up. So I think when you have like a dream for so long, you kind of have to be like, is this still my dream, or do I just think this is still what I want to do? And then especially as kind of like reality started to sit in a bit, I was like, people, like my people are not, you know, served well in medicine. Like there's a lot going on in the world of medicine. Do I want to get into that? And I think it was kind of that thought of like, okay, it's not really about what you want, it's what you need to do. So I was like, I need to be there, actually. I need to become that leader. So I kind of reevaluated, made sure it was what I wanted to do. And then, yeah, now I'm here.
Yeah, you're right on. Yeah.
Thank you. Well, it's been an interesting journey because the goal first was law. But it's like your African family, there's West Indian families, very similar. Law, med, engineering. So my dad came here from Trinidad to do engineering. Landed in Montreal, lasted one semester, because that's literally the first time he and his friends were seeing snow, so they headed west right quick. UBC engineering. But I kind of just did the law thing, because I think that's what was expected in our family. I have a lot of cousins who are lawyers. We have a family, I don't know by blood. Who, you know, uncle, aunties, who knows who's real and who's not. Some of you will know because he was in the news and during COVID, Uncle Selwyn Romilly, Justice Romilly, Supreme Court Justice. So I think people in the family just thought, well, that's easy. We have one. We got one. Right? So he can help lift you up, right? And but it also felt like pressure, right? So I'm like, I don't know. So I went and worked at a law firm, one of my cousins' law firms, Braylon McKenzie, then went over to, you know, the top of the TV tower downtown. There's a great law firm called Alexander Holborn. But when I was there, you know, I was like a go Friday kind of, you know, coffee, photocopying, run to court, you know, where's my briefcase kind of thing. And one of my lawyers came in and came out of her office, and Natty was there with the baby in the pram, right, in the stroller. And kind of just quickly did a 10-minute, you know, and then boom, and then she's like, oh, I won't see that baby till like 10 o'clock tonight. And I'm like, this is not what I want, right? Yeah, it could have been easy for me, like, because there were people and pathways and reference letters ready to go, but no, I felt I was an English major, I loved English, I loved literature, and so teaching was it for me. And then I found that you can do that volunteer side, that make a difference in your community piece, really work well in education. Also, I know what it was like to be the one and only. So even though I'm super light-skinned, when you're a kid, you're not, because you're in the sun all the time. And it was the late 70s, early 80s, so I went from an afro, enjoy that when you're the only one, to like basically soul glow. You remember those California curls and all that, right? So I know what it's like to be the only one, and I thought, who's for us? Like, who? I had to, as a 9-year-old, as a 7-year-old, find my culture, like create opportunities to investigate and learn about my own culture, because no one else was going to. So I had to wait for the pick your country and do a paper, or, you know, find a holiday or a cult, you know, that sort of thing. And I'm like, 9-year-olds and 7-year-olds shouldn't have to be responsible. You can't be what you can't see. Right. And so I wanted more representation. And that's kind of what inspired me. I know that when I was teaching, at first I was like, I don't know if I want to keep going, but sometimes kids come and they're like, because I saw you, my trajectory is longer, right? Mm-hmm. And so because I can bring Black folks in, like these folks, into the school, and I, especially now, my job now, even more as an administrator, I can make arrangements and have events and help kids see representation and see themselves in other things, right? But I'm telling you, if as a Black youth, and I don't mean speaking for you, because I'm right here, in a public school in British Columbia, one of the last things you think about is spending another 30 years in this building, right? Because it's not fun. Mm-hmm. Like, you hear the N-words 2, 3, 4 multiple times a day, mm-hmm. right? That doesn't feel good. So why would I want to spend the rest of my life doing this, right? And so that's why BC Bella exists, because we're trying to say, we need you, right? We can change it together. But that lack of representation is what really inspired me to keep going.
Thank you so much. Also, do you remember when the song Freaky Friday came out, to your last point? I don't know if you remember the song, but that's a very touchy point for me as like as a Black child at school, so that's very meaningful. Thank you.
Madeline, Freaky Friday. Freaky Friday was a song?
Yeah, it was. Oh. There's a lot of N-words in that song.
Yep.
A lot of white children in that song. Okay, so our next question is especially very relevant to you as educators. So what does building Black futures mean to you in your personal life and in your career?
So I'll talk really quickly, because I'm not really an educator, I'm getting educated. But I think to me, the main thing is, you know, when I walk into a lot of my, you know, STEM classes, especially computer science, I want to like survey the room. I want to see people who are also from, you know, my background, because, you know, there's no requirement based on your looks to be, you know, pursue computer science. You know, that shouldn't be a barrier. You know, I want to walk into rooms, for example, when I was interning at Amazon, you know, I don't want to go multiple floors up or down before I see the first Black engineer. You know what I mean? So it's just, you know, that feeling of the future should mean representation. You know, you should have engineers, you should have scientists, who are from these marginalized groups, like Black people, and we just want more representation in that space. You know, we don't all have to be athletes, we don't all have to be rappers. You know, that's how the stereotype goes, but, you know, there are other opportunities, and, you know, we need to get our foot through that door. We need to overcome the obstacles to show that, you know, we're more than whatever predefined societal kind of like archetype there is. So I'll pass it on to an educated.
I resonate with that a lot. I just got to go backwards a little bit real quick. I just came back from a retreat. And on this retreat that I was in, it was a part of our master class that was mandatory that we go on this retreat up by Whistler. From Sunday last week to Friday, we did Tai Chi every morning, meditated, journal, and from Tuesday to Thursday, we sat in 36 hours of silence. I don't often talk this slow.
Hey.
I'm actually coming back from a retreat. And it's killing me. I really don't talk this slow. I work with that all the time. Business, and I'm saying, she's probably like, why is he talking so slow? 36 hours of silence really does something when you start to find yourself and the environment starts to speak to you and the river is singing songs to you. And so, I apologize for my slow approach. we have 600 students who are Black in Surrey. We have 600 students who are Black in Surrey. And so I made sure to meet them all. And I have. Yeah, they'll tell you they know Nick Brown. And I literally, physically went to their schools and shared space with them. Not only in February, any day. Mm-hmm. I joke with them all the time. I said, I had to be Black yesterday, I have to be Black today, I have to be Black tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And they're always like, we know Nick. But it's that reminder that I still have to be Black. I can't change that, I can't separate that, and that's a fact. So for these 600 Black students, this is good, right on time. Y'all move like me. Like y'all came back from a retreat. Just strolling, this is good. For those 600 plus Black students, I created Youth as Changemakers. It's not up to Black students to teach white students on how to understand anti-racism. However, if they wanted to be a part of that, no problem. So when I created Youth as Changemakers, I was thinking of, you know, y'all parents, where you're not sending your kid to school to teach others. What was more important about it though, there were Black students that was like, you know what? I want to talk to these kids. And so for the last 2.5 years, we created curriculum from kindergarten to grade 7, where students go into their elementary, high school students go into their elementary schools and teach anti-racism. And just real quick, it's actually kind of dope if you ever have the chance or the time, reach out to me and to come out to those schools, because from K to 2, the high school students read the kindergarten to grade 2, Goodnight Racism, where they just put racism to bed. grade 3 to 5 is like a physical activity where it's about microaggressions, but stand on this side of the room if you think it's okay to comment on your hair or touch it, or you speak English so well. And then grade 6 to 7 is a deeper conversation around the N-word and microaggressions. I try not to use humor, but I can't stop laughing. Because we were in the grade 5 class and one of the kids put their hand up and was just like, well, what if my teacher is racist? and everybody in the room slowly turned up. I said, she was, and I checked.
Okay.
still in retreat.
I thank you both. I think for me, it really is like about giving back. I find that's what I find the most meaningful. And also because I do think it can be easy sometimes to just, when you're locked in, you have so much to worry about in front of you, it's sometimes hard to remember, like, I want to bring people with me. Like, I need to actually go back. So, like, even me coming here today, like, when Olivia asked me, I was like, it'd be really easy, like, midterm studying, I don't, but it's like, no, like, this is what changed it for me to be like, that's an option. And so, really, when you do get those opportunities to give back, and also seeking them out, too, I think is really important. And I think also, like, community, like, the people around you is a really key component, because I think it's really important to support each other, because, like, these things that we're doing are really hard, and they can be really lonely, and so you want to make sure the people around you stay around you as well, that you're not leaving anyone behind, so that everyone is still coming with you. So, yeah, that's me.
Thank you. So, on the same lines, community is huge for me too, so building Black futures is building a community. You know that famous quote, takes a village, right? But one of my mentors is Dr. George Sefide, the godfather of anti-racism in Canadian education, and or NANA, if you're so lucky to be able to call him that, says, but you have to build the village, right? You have to build it though, right? So that community piece is so important. So whenever I'm working on an initiative for youth, for students, for educators, any time I can show the love and the joy and the, of our community, of Black communities, that's what I'm gonna do. So I have an opportunity to bring in music, food, right? And bring in members of our community, help uplift them, right? So, and uplift Black businesses. When I was a child, I sat in, you know, we used to sit in the stairs and listen to a grown-ups talk at night, right? Mm-hmm. I heard so many arguments. My father was trying to get a community center back in the 70s, 80s. I don't know if some of you are older and you remember this or know this. But the Caribbean groups couldn't get together, right? The Trinis and the Jamaicans and the Barbados, and they couldn't get it together. And it was so frustrating. I remember the arguments and like, oh, why can't we just get together, right? That's, to me, the antithesis of that, the opposite of that, is building Black futures. Like, we have to get over it. We have to stop fighting for scraps under the table, right? We deserve a seat at the table. We should be setting that table, right? We should be building that table. And so for me, just making sure people get to the table from our communities and that we have a say, not just token, right? A real say. And so I start preparing youth for that, though, too. Like, any opportunity I can to bring a youth, you know, as soon as I know you are good at something or you want something, finding that, helping you build that future, right? And some people are like, oh, it's just individual one-on-one. But we also have bigger projects, like, sorry, SFU, I'm sure you're going to get one soon too, but UBC has UBC Black Futures, where we bring like hundreds of kids from across the Lower Mainland so they can see themselves on campus.
Right.
That's what this is today, so congratulations, SFU, is fantastic. It does work, right? Where people, because kids sometimes think, this, I could be here, and so when they meet a Black person who's doing it and doing well, being a student, being a professional, whatever, running their own business, that changes everything. That so lengthens their trajectory, right? So yeah, that's why I think there's a student here today from one of our high schools. I know she's a brilliant artist. I need art.
Yes.
Just renovated my house. I'm gonna hire her,
yeah.
Right? I hope she's not here. I don't want to embarrass her. Okay. So, but in this process of me getting her to do art, I'm gonna show her like how to do it. Like, where's your portfolio? Like, do you have it together? I'm gonna show this piece of art when people come to my home, and I'm gonna give it, like, do you have a, you need business cards, right? Mm-hmm. You're gonna have to be ready. Do you have a website? Like, this is how we build Black futures, right? I know girls who love hair. They love hair. They love to do hair. And so I introduce them to hairdressers, like, who have successful salons. And like, this is an option. If you're serious, we can get you an apprenticeship, right? That's building futures.
And again, that was the BSC Student Day panel that took place on Friday, February the 6th. I am so glad that I had the opportunity to hang out and get to, you know, stay through the whole panel because the discussion was incredible. And now I am at the end of this episode this week. I want to thank you for listening to another episode of Intravenous celebrating Black History Month on CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, BC. However, before I make way for Democracy Now, I am going to end with another track off of Sergeant and Comrade's album Lo-Fi Future, and the track is called Lo-Fi Future.
Good for your system. It's that lo-fi future. Listen.